Fear does not exist in this dojo. Pain does not exist in this dojo. We do not train to be merciful here. This is a place of learning. This is a place of knowledge. For years we've gotten from Karate Kid and Cobra Kai. And now it's time for us to get back.
It'll open up a way for us to talk about all kinds of martial arts movies. There's also like no way to not compare those instantly to Karate Kid.
Man, face you, he is your enemy, and the enemy deserves no mercy. We teach the way of the mic. Welcome to Dojo 9.
I was going to say, if we could get back to the royal couple of Karate Kid of Daniel LaRusso and Ali.
Yes, which is now here. I'm going to lose a lot of fans. That's not my favorite Karate Kid love story. It's not even my top two or three Karate Kid love stories.
Nice.
So I love Elizabeth Shue. She's brilliant.
Yeah.
She was in Karate Kid and Back to the Future, and those are some of my favorite series, but her work in those is not my favorite of hers or my favorite of those, and that's not
no
to disparage anything.
Babysitting, I'll say that.
She was really good in Karate Kid. She's great. I really love her work in the first film. But their love story is not, you know, it's like, I don't know. It just didn't really come together. Like Daniel and Kumiko
in part two.
I think they are fucking star-crossed lovers, born to be together. I kind of don't like Amanda on Cobra Kai a little bit, just a teeny little bit. I kind of don't like her just because she's not fucking Kumiko,
The wife? Oh my God, Carrie.
A little tiny bit. Like
she was I'm not liking the wife. I'm like, nobody likes the wife. Nobody likes.
I kind of come and go on that. Like this, she'll do this, and I'm like, oh, she's so sweet. And then she'll do that, and I'll be like, oh, I don't like that. You know?
Yeah. Season one, she's definitely. It's hard. She's the acquired taste, I would say. If there was ever there are elements, you know, and one of the things that's beautiful about that show is not that it was a reboot, not that it was a retread, not that it was a restart. It's like literally we're talking about the events of the first film, and you have Daniel LaRusso saying, I did that 30 years ago, I could do it again. You know, you're like, yeah, shit, 30 years ago. Oh my God. God, it was so long.
And in reality, it was more like 36 years ago now.
Yeah. But
which is incredible.
What used to happen in movies at that time, though, was I felt like the love story was always on the fast track. And maybe as the audience, we weren't old enough to realize, like, that's like unrealistically fast. You know what I mean? Like, these days, you're like, holy shit. That would be considered like, yo, dude, she's stalking you a little bit. You're stalking her. I don't know. This thing's doomed from the get-go. And back then, though, it was totally cute and on pace. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you what, though, man. The best fucking love story in the whole Karate Kid series, if it's not Miyagi and Daniel, is the father-son love story, of course, which is brilliant and beautifully done. But to me, the best like romantic love story in the whole franchise is Miyagi and Kumiko in part two.
Oh.
And, you know, that... Or, I'm sorry, Miyagi and Yukie, not Kumiko.
Yukie.
Miyagi and Yukie in part two is, you know, that is just fucking one of my all-time favorites of any fucking movie.
I guess three is the one that was sort of lauded universally as the worst of the trilogy.
I need your title. You don't enter, that affects my financial future, Daniel. Get it? You think you can rely on that crane crap? Last time you weren't fighting this.
Mr. Miyagi loves you. He has faith in you.
This guy wants to break you, humiliate you, stomp you into the ground. Yes!
I'm sorry if you don't like it, but I got problems, and if you're not going to be part of the solution, don't give me a hard time about it.
No, the man must make a choice, and the kid must become a man.
You are going to defend. You're getting in that ring.
What am I doing?
First he suffers, then he suffers some more.
Ralph Macchio, Pat Morita, a John G. Avildsen film, The Karate Kid, Part 3.
But I think before that, people weren't really crazy about 2, right?
Well, you know, No, two was very successful. And it's interesting because people have forgotten how successful two was. Two made more money than one. And yeah, one was a big hit. I think the only movie that outgrossed one in 84 was Ghostbusters. Whoa. And Karate Kid wasn't pushed like Ghostbusters was pushed. You know, Karate Kid was like a sleeper hit. It was kind of like, well, you know, I don't know, whatever. But what a year for Columbia Pictures, right?
Right, right. Well, I saw the second one in the theaters, but I didn't see the first one in the theaters, so that definitely...
Oh, see, I saw the third one in the theaters. I was born in 84, so I was a little too young even when the second one was out. But yeah, the third one was the first movie I ever saw without my parents in the theater
with me.
It was like me, my sister, and a couple of our neighbors, these twins who were, you know, really good family friends. And that was really cool, and I really liked that movie. You know, at the time, you know, I'm 5 years old. I couldn't really. I just saw a fucking Karate Kid movie on the big screen. My mind was blown. It was great. Summer of '89. It was the first time I was doing that. Like Uncle Buck. You know, that was amazing. Wow. Seeing that on the big screen without my parents. Like that was such an adventure. You know.
Yeah.
And that was part of the culture too. Like we were talking about Lucille being divorced. You know. That was very topical for the day. You know, E.T. dealt with divorce. That was kind of the thing of the... We were starting to get that into the culture of, like, divorced parents, broken homes, stuff. You know, and even though Lucille wasn't divorced, she was a widower.
Right.
But that was still single parent, you know. That was sort of like, you know, the new reality for film and stuff when they wanted to kind of authenticate it or place it into the modern day realities that people were dealing with.
And it was taking it a few more steps away from the holdover like 50s era, like, oh, we still have topics that are kind of taboo for movies and TV shows. Everything still needs to fit a little bit of a safer model for us. And like the other thing, too, I mean, there is a certain element of this first movie that was really also just to advertise the idea of karate. You know what I mean? It was the early 80s. It was before karate became the thing. Where I grew up, it was taekwondo. Everybody was doing taekwondo if they did martial arts. It was, I know, at the elementary school, one of our teachers taught taekwondo. I didn't do it. A lot of my friends did, though. And that was another way that I felt like this movie was relatable. But that was the era where it was all starting. I didn't realize that this wasn't sort of an already established thing, which, you know, the All Valley, the way this movie sets up that as like this kind of Mount Olympus fight of the gods kind of thing, you get the sense that karate is already really ingrained in the culture out there. In general,
they have a line in Cobra Kai that is really great, where they're like, you know, back in the day, karate in the valley was like football in Texas.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, that makes sense. And you just buy it. And you buy it in the movies. You buy it on the show. I don't know if it's true or not, but I buy it.
And if it's not true, it doesn't ruin the movie or the show for me. So keep it.
Exactly. Yeah, it really doesn't. but, you know, we should, you know, talk about the second one for a bit before we get into the third and all that.
Yeah.
The second one, I feel like, is legitimately underappreciated as one of the great blockbuster sequels of all time. I mean, I think story-wise, it packs just as much emotional wallop as the first film, which is almost impossible. You can count the fucking movies that have done that on one hand. And I think you get, for the most part, better action. Now, with the caveat, the I will say the fight choreography is probably not the best of any of the Karate Kids in part two.
You know, I remember
even as a little kid, the Chosen fight at the end, I could see that was like bad WWF wrestling.
Okay. I was going to say also there's a few parts. I mean, like, you know,
but
nothing will detract from Miyagi, but the garden defending scene felt a little like you could see them waiting for their turns and stuff.
Going, of course. And again, that's an older standard. Right. You know, we totally bought it back then on VHS and shit like that. You know, you watch it now in 4K, you know, for the 10,000th time, and you can see that shit.
Right.
But story wise, those fights are better than almost any other fights in any other martial arts movies, because, you know, the build up between, you know, Miyagi and Sato and Danny Kamakona is just incredible. I love. Good, you know, bad guy Sato is one of the best villains ever, and good guy Sato is one of the fucking my favorite shits ever. Like, if there's ever a dude I want to sit down and drink with, I don't even drink, but I would drink whatever Sato wanted me to when he was good guy Sato.
Yeah, like when he shows up and he's like, I rebuild whole village, and you're like, oh, dude. But before that, dude. I mean, how scary is it when they first arrive?
His line just fucking, so coward.
Yeah.
You return.
Like when they get in the car, and they're driving, and it's like, where are we going? He's like, oh, don't worry, my uncle wants to see you. And then they pull in.
Yeah, some things have changed since you go, Miyagi-san. Some things have not, huh?
I'm getting chills just thinking.
As you have lived, a coward.
Oh my God, no, you are dead to me. Like, dude, what? Oh, yeah. When he turned off.
Oh my God.
Everything about that movie.
And the fucking, first of all, this movie's got metaphors out the ass. Can we talk about the log breaking metaphor, which is so fucking beautiful? You know, hey, can you break a log like that? Don't know. Never been attacked by a tree. You know, it is one of the fucking best setups to one of the best fucking metaphors ever, dude. It's so fucking good. You know, the fact that Miyagi has never even pondered the idea of fighting a tree, because why the fuck would he? He knows how deadly he is, and he, you know, hates fighting anyways. And he loves nature.
Karate is only
Sato has been spending his whole life attacking the same tree, the same piece of wood for 40 years. This wood we find together on beach that time?
Oh, my God.
And he's so pissed when Miyagi brings that up. So pissed.
And meanwhile, he was like, you know, he's wealthy. He's got like a palace. It's one of those like
Sato's family was richest in village. Yukie's was poorest. Good arrangement.
He kind of like became his own jailer, you know, like his his need for vengeance kept him in a prison. Whereas like Miyagi went to America. I mean, maybe he lost his wife. You know, there is a lot of stuff that happened.
Yeah, Miyagi lost a lot, but he never regretted any of that, and he never felt like he lost his honor. He never felt like he was disgraced, you know.
Now, to be fair, we had those moments in the first movie with drunken Miyagi having to break down.
And of course, the studio wanted them to cut it.
But my God, that's the stuff. Watching it as a grown-up, realizing I had no idea how intense that was as a kid.
I had no idea. I just thought he got drunk and cried. And then, you know.
Also, when he's like, you know, the power in how much he feels that truth. And then when Sato shows up in the second movie, always with sunglasses and never looks Miyagi in the eye. You know what I mean? So that they carry that over into the second film.
And I love, you know, that is one of my favorite Pat Morita acting moments, actually. He set the stage. He explained to Daniel and the audience how bad Sato is of a guy and all this, you know, you get it and you see him and he's huge and he's intimidating. He's in that dark garage. It's beautiful. And even still, Miyagi's face lights up because he just sees his best friend. And he's like, Sato, like, how are you? You know, like he's just trying to be, you know, the fucking good guy. He's trying to love his best friend. And that's one of the great bromances ever. But, you know, getting back to the log thing, I just love this whole this idea that Sato's been attacking trees his whole life and advertising it. And, you know, then the tree finally attacks him back in the storm. And the tree would have killed him, you know, the log, the board, the piece of his home.
Yeah.
And when Miyagi comes to break that board is one of the fucking best buildups ever. I mean, this movie's got a lot of good buildups. The ice scene is a great buildup.
Yes. Oh,
beautifully
man.
Edited. And I love the way Sato looks when they're fucking breathing. Sato looks over from the bar and there's this look in his face where he's like, motherfucker, he's going to break them all. Because he knows as soon as he sees him doing that breathing, he's like, fuck. He might as well just put his money down and walked out right there. But it's you know, it's great so he can, you know, say, do not embarrass Uncle again.
Yeah, right. Like, to maintain honor, dude. Maintain honor, you know. And that's real great game moment, face man. Is, you know. This is this is old school rivalry to the point where, like, you know, it's gone decades. These days, it's sort of like everybody tracks each other down on their GPS, you know, or you know, God knows what, the dark web is a scary place. But, you know, there's something about both of these first two movies that sort of, I don't know, it was earthbound Star Wars level wisdom. You know what I mean? Like, it was earthbound force.
Yes, yes, totally. Abso-fucking-lutely. And, you know, you know, I think there's a lot of just messaging in these movies, if you really think about it.
The The New Jersey HorrorCon reputation is exploding. The atmosphere you guys had created. New Jersey HorrorCon was my entree into an actual horror convention.
Love it.
And you guys are doing a great job.
That is amazing. I'm super proud and super inspired to hear that. I mean, that's a testament to the community of cons and, you know, of horror and stuff in general.
My God.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's Carmen Electra.
Hey, hey,
wow, we are all giving high fives to an absolute icon.
This is incredible.
Trailblazer, amazing. You are amazing. Carmen Electra,
absolutely.
Be well.
Safe.
Thank you so much.
Love.
Have a good one. Be well.
So
you can't see it on radio, but she's still
God.
Got it.
Oh, my God, yes.
That's
absolutely.
My wife.
Still
right
got
my wife gets the picture of Carmen Electra.
The wife does it. There you go, wife. Good job, wife. That's a keeper. That wife's a keeper.
Are you having a blast?
I am having a blast. Are you having a blast?
I am.
This place is awesome, right?
What's your most favorite part of the whole day so far?
When the guy dressed like Gene Simmons from Kiss stopped in front of our booth and we put Strutter on and he did a lip sync to the whole thing.
Guys, if you haven't subscribed yet, go ahead and do that.
Yesterday I bumped into Michael Winslow. I got to have this whole experience where Leslie Easterbrook was lost and looking for her autograph table and I got to take her all around.
It's spooky, actually. I'm going to turn the chair around a little bit so I can see you.
Oh, all right.
Keep an eye on you. I saw you and I thought, this guy knows everything. Terrific and sound in here with you.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, it's
really
amazing
clear.
How it...
Damon Della Greca of Slasher, this awesome app.
I wanted to do something that would really make it for these people who just love to create, who love horror.
Thank you for what you're doing, dude. It's great that you put this together.
Absolutely, man. It's always good to see you.
We're trying to have as much fun, and we want people to have fun with us, and that's why we got guys like you stop by the table, hang out. We got to do the radio thing for a little bit.
He's from Jersey. I'm from the South, so.
And I'm from the Bronx, so.
So we're all still friends. That's good.
So we're all good. Daniel Frankenstein. I'm representing psychothematicmedia.com. Call ourselves a creative collective.
My name is Gail Bykowitz.
Yeah, I'm Hector De La Rosa. We're partners in crime here. We're doing special effects makeup, and we're also independent filmmakers.
When I ran into them earlier, they were definitely vampire cowboys.
I love Better Off Dead. I love Bill and Ted's. And I'm just so glad that you guys remember those films.
Oh my God, those movies. I would go to school and just try and talk like Bill and Ted all day.
Those triumphant times.
I want my $2, man. Right? I've walked around wanting those $2 for how many years now?
This is fantastic. But of course, we need some language lessons.
David Clone from the Hollow Knight Network, and by now you know what it's time for you to do. Let's go on over to NewJerseyHorrorCon.com, get yourself some tickets, and check out this awesome event where we are lifetime sponsors. We will be there from now until infinitum with all these incredible guests that are going to be at the next one, bringing you all the awesome from the show floor right to your digital door, right here at Hollow9.com at the New Jersey Horror Con and Film Festival.
Did you get it? I hope you got it. That's good. See you soon.
When you come to problems in life, if you stop and you say, all right, what would Mr. Miyagi do?
Yeah.
You're probably not going to make some rash, hot-headed, selfish, asshole decision. You know, if you're like, what would Mr. Miyagi do? And you do that, I feel like at least, half the time you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Probably way more than that, he's a guy who could beat the shit out of anyone, but he hates fighting. He would never fight unless he absolutely had to.
Yeah. Rule number one, karate only for defense.
Yeah. Why train? So you don't have to fight.
Rule number two, always study rule number one. Yeah, you're like, first. Dude. that's so simple. And...
Yeah,
it's hard for people. Look at even the way other movies that feature martial arts, where it's all about aggression, and I mean, even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, kind of a little bit of trying to be the same way, but...
Yeah, they tried to put a little Miyagi in Splinter, for sure.
But it's definitely when you have an army of bad guys attacking and they just have to be swinging wildly and chucking and using, bow staffs and stuff. It's not... And I like how, I remember one of the first couple, maybe first 6 months I had like my first real job as an adult, the job I was just at for about 16 years. But it was like first year getting used to the grind, a little bit of the, wow, man, the wonderment of being a kid out of college is gone. So, I'm home on a Friday night and I'm toasting my brain because it's been a rough week and Karate Kid is on. And like, it was the first time it dawned on me how Miyagi is like the most genius level sensei ever, because he took finding a way to bring a guy from no experience to being able to defend himself against black belts over the course of like a couple weeks by having him do, you know, routine lawn maintenance and, you know, waxing cars and sanding the deck.
He could have taught him that shit any way he wanted. 10,000 different ways he could have taught him that shit. But he needed his fence painted. He needed his deck sanded. He needed, you know, his fucking cars washed.
It's like and a two birds, one stone situation, you know?
It's three birds even, because not only is he teaching Daniel muscle memory, but he's building up his inner ability to take punishment, you know?
Yeah.
To, you know, he's toughening this kid's mental fortitude. And I think that's something that a lot of people overlook in the first movie.
I mean, the scene when Miyagi first tells him to like show me Sanda floor, and then like
he goes
to
do it,
and he's like, and he actually like attacks him. I remember I was, granted, I was high as hell. My mind was struggling to hang on to reality, but I was like, you see the frustration in this guy that he doesn't want to say in words. Like, do you understand what you got yourself into and what I'm getting you out of and what I've given you, and you're bitching at me because I went fishing? Fuck you. I'm going to attack you as hard as I can. And wow, you just defended yourself. I was like, I had like a religious epiphany watching that scene that time, that I was like, from now on, Karate Kid is ingrained in my blood as one of the main things about life that has been reflected on film.
Abso-fucking-lutely. Abso-fucking-lutely, man. It's just gold, man. It's, you know, it's become like my religion. And, you know, there's a couple movies that are so much part of my life, they become a religion to me. It's really mostly the Karate Kids, Back to the Futures, and Bill and Ted's. Where I think like within those movies is the meaning of life, you know. Yeah. And I truly believe this. You know, it's your future's not, you know, written. Your future hasn't been written yet. It's whatever you make it a good one. From the end of Back to the Future 3, which is like the redeeming line of them making me sit through a Western.
Which I actually loved. I know everybody hates that one, but you know,
I love the movie. I just feel like, you know, in hindsight, it, you know, could have been something other than a Western. Just Western was too off-brand compared to what the first two movies were. They were so, like, you know, current and high-tech and topical, and then it was just, I don't know. But at any rate, it's that. It's, you know, party on, dudes. Be excellent to each other, Bill and Ted. And it's so many things from Karate Kid and Cobra Kai. You know, I think there's an episode of Cobra Kai, I think it's maybe 7 or 8 in season 1, where him and Robbie are training in the woods, and he's explaining to him, you know, he's like, I know how hard it is growing up without a dad. Believe me, I know. You know, that's when you got to dig down deep and find the good stuff, and then you can have some balance in your life. And, oh, man, that just hits me every fucking time, right? In the field. I mean, that's what it's like, you know? That's the meaning of life, in a sense, that you have to dig down deep for the good stuff, because everyone has shit times. Everyone has bad days. Everyone has a shit year. Everyone's been through a 2020 before.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And I think it's the idea too that we're all sort of winging it, and nobody realizes that nobody knows what's going on, you know.
Which is another thing they address beautifully in Cobra Kai when he's talking to Miyagi's grave. He's like, I don't know if you were just better at hiding it.
Yeah,
you always seem to have the answers, you know.
You know, and that's so much about it. And I almost feel like maybe this show coming out now feels like a little bit more of a gift to you and me and people in our generation to kind of check back in. You know, I mean, we were talking about it earlier. You know, I think when we watched the movies at the time in our life that it was, and even still watching it now, I remember it. I definitely was aligned much more with LaRusso. I felt like he was the one I was supposed to, I guess, identify with. And then maybe in the other movies, there were elements from other characters, and especially getting older, you start to see the John Kreese moments that we kind of might have sometimes, or the moments we wish we had our own Miyagi. And then now we've got Cobra Kai, and I'm like, oh, shit, now we're in the point where the cautionary tale of becoming Johnny, or at least what Johnny is at the beginning of season 1, is a lot more present in my mind from both.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's much more of a picture of my life.
Like, holy fucking shit, man.
I have my past, you know, my karate and my good old days, and you know, I use karate with quotations because I don't actually know karate, but you know, I think about a lot of the shit I was doing, you know, when I was younger, in my 20s and stuff like that, and everything seemed so hopeful. You know, I was like playing in a band and touring the country and all this stuff, and then it just kind of ended, you know? Yeah. And then, you know, you you're sitting around watching like Iron Eagle and shit like that, you know, and you're just like kind of stuck in the past. You're not really moving forward, you know. It's another metaphor they talk very much.
You're aging, but you're not moving forward, and moving forward gets harder and harder. Now, that's one of the things that's crazy is seeing William Zabka. I mean, he was popping up in movies, obviously, between then and now. But I feel like he tapered off to the point where him being the focus of the show was sort of like, oh man, you know, in the age of the Breaking Bads and the anti-heroes, what a fucking novel idea. Because I mean, we definitely have to talk about three, and I don't want to get too far into Cobra Kai before we mention the things that I do like and the things that are horrible about three.
Well, there's a lot to talk about with three about what could have been and what should have been as well.
And there's still things to talk about with two. I think this is going to be a multi-part, what do they call that? Fucking in college. See, I'm a little green right now. I can't remember. Seminar? Multi-part seminar on the Karate Kid franchise. But, you know, it's kind of, I think that helped that part, you know, the idea that he was sort of like, people saw him in like Hot Tub Time Machine, he popped up, and you'll remember him from like, you know, Back to School, but the
just one of the guys, of course.
Just one of the guys. Oh my God. He was basically Johnny in that movie too.
Yeah.
It was
exactly.
Like a different day.
And even Terry Griffith, they picked her because they knew with the short hair, she was going to look like LaRusso. That was a big part of it. It's Columbia Pictures.
Oh my God. I have to
Columbia
rewatch
Pictures
that after we're
the
done
next
that.
Year. Yeah. Oh man. I've, you know, I have a deep respect for Just One of the Guys. To me, that's kind of like Karate Kid's like little sister movie.
Yeah, no, it's and it's a great, you know, that movie too. It's a number of people and the moments. And I think there's something about all these movies, especially too, bringing up like Bill and Ted's. And and it's funny because I always felt a little bit alone on the island of hanging on to lines from movies like this and letting them, you know, they play through my mind as you're walking through life and those moments. Oh, yeah, and you're like, oh shit, you know, that it applies. And I used to think that I was kind of weird for that. You know what I mean? But then when you think about how much this all speaks, and then the fact that that's why the new show works, because there's so many people that it spoke to on that level.
Yeah, when they drop those little references and those even those subtle little things, you know, fans go fucking apeshit. Like when they even, you know, when Kreese says a buddy, oh, you might not be that far yet.
Yeah, that'll be season two. Oh, I mean, I'm halfway through season two. So.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's a line, you know, it's an off-the-cuff thing. It's not spoilery, so I'll just say it. But, you know, there's that picture of Kreese that we keep seeing in all the movies where he's in Vietnam, you know, the black and white image, you know. And it's just, you know, there's a, you know, it's on the wall at one point, and he just says, you know, totally like off the cuff, not really related that much to what's going on. He just says, a buddy of mine took that photo. And I'm just like, oh my God, I know what fucking buddy he's talking about. Like, yes.
Is that our buddy Terry Silver from Park?
Yes. Oh, you don't understand. I was writing my own Cobra Kai before they did Cobra Kai. And my Cobra Kai was completely different. My Cobra Kai was a Vietnam buddy cop concept of Silver and Kreese. And honestly, I hope to God, that's one of my life goals, is that someone lets me make this fucking thing.
That would be because that would be the next direction to go with this. You know what I mean?
For sure, like, yeah. Or Young Miyagi and Sato in Okinawa. That would be amazing too. But I don't think I would have as clear of a take on that as I do on Kreese and Silver in Vietnam. It's all mapped out in my head. I know exactly how they got there, where they came from, where they go after, you know, how it all fits in. Like, that is just like, I'm foaming at the mouth for the chance to do that. I might just have to write it anyways because I want it to be a thing.
Yeah, well then, and then I think it would be an interesting thing to do to A-B that with the young Miyagi story at the same time. Like, what's Miyagi doing at that time? Maybe he's just moving to America, you know what
I
mean?
No, because that time Miyagi would have been in America for many years. You know, he came to America in the 40s.
Well, yeah,
late 30s or early 40s.
He fought in the war.
He fought in World War II.
Fighting in the war while his wife was dying, giving birth to their kid.
And that's the interesting, you know, that's the only real thing other than karate that connects Miyagi and Kreese, is obviously they're all fucking veterans. They all been through war.
Yeah.
They've all been through the absolute hell of, you know, what, you know, the human life experience can be, that probably doesn't get any worse than war. And Miyagi's hell was probably way worse than theirs.
You could call the show Banzai and it be about all of them.
Oh man. Yeah, well, fucking A. In my mind, it was going to be called Cobra Kai. Well, but of course that happened. So
Cobra
that's
Kai's already taken now.
Yeah, it's taken now. So
that would be sick though, because I think what one of the other things that this show does is shows that if you do it the right way, you could really do some cool things with some existing intellectual properties instead of remaking them or making a shitty sequel. You know what I mean? That is already not even respecting the spirit of the original. I love this era of picking up 20 years later, 30 years later with an existing property and doing more with it or seeing where their kids go. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, totally. Especially when it's done right. The reason Cobra Kai works is because they nailed these young characters. They are so perfect. They could not have done a better job in writing these characters, and for the most part casting them and stuff like that. The kids are not only great actors, but they are all very good with the fight scenes and stuff like that. They are, they are much, more physically gifted than than young, Machio was, or even young Zabka and stuff. The only real martial artists in the Karate Kid movies were Sean Kanan from the third one. He was a real martial artist.
Was that Thomas Ian Griffith, bad boy Mike Barnes?
Yep, Mike Barnes and Terry Silver. Those guys are both real martial artists.
Oh wow, that's awesome.
And Daryl Vidal, who is in the tournament. You remember, he's the one who fights Johnny in the semifinals. He does a lot of like spinning kicks and stuff. Yeah. So Vidal, they reference him in season two. I don't know if you've gotten there yet, but he was actually Miyagi's stunt double, and he invented the crane kick. And John Avildsen's such a sweet guy. He made sure everyone knew. He made a YouTube video with Daryl Vidal saying, "Look, this is the guy who made the crane kick, and he doesn't get credit, and people don't believe him. I directed Karate Kid. I'm telling the world he invented the crane kick. So thank you, because you made my movie awesome with your incredible kick." And when Miyagi's doing the crane on the stumps, that's Daryl Vidal.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
These movies are packed to the gills with those stories, and it kills me there's not enough stories from the sequels. There really are not enough.
As far as what they've explored in Cobra Kai so far, or
no, I just mean I could tell you 100 fucking hours of stories about the making of Karate Kid Part 1. How Ralph and this guy got, how they trained these guys, how they trained those guys, how they cast it, how they edited it, how Jerry Weintraub fit, everyone's backstory, detailed descriptions. But in Karate Kid 2, there's only like a few stories that I've ever been able to like find out about. And Karate Kid 3, there's maybe a little bit more known than 2, but not by a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, most of the stuff I know about 3, I definitely know from the same podcast that was afraid to do a Miyagi impression, what they had done the third movie before they did the first movie. And the only thing that I think they brought to light that I wasn't aware of before was the whole Ralph Macchio's wife, Ralph Macchio being a little too worried that his wife would be upset if he had a love interest. So that's
really weird thing. And I feel bad for Robin Lively.
It's kind of bullshit. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, it's a really, they gave her a tough, tough role to do, and people don't like her. I think she's fine. I actually really like that role and that character.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting choice, right? Because it's a step a little bit more towards reality and a little more kind of woke, as not just having these disposable sex objects.
Yeah, it was more like they could have a platonic love interest. Like, it's, hey, fuck it, man.
I think it's cool. And in my mind, they're still friends. And maybe they even had a little romantic run-in in their late 20s or early 30s after,
That better happen in season 3. You know what I mean? Like,
I would be okay with that. I would rather see, in some ways, I would rather see Daniel with Jessica Andrews than I would with Allie, or than I would with Amanda, maybe even. I hate to say it, but it's a soap opera now, and I love that about it. So someone's gonna get divorced, or someone's gonna cheat, or someone's gonna do, some shit's gonna happen.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Now broadcasting from our new home on the web, hollow9.com, where you can find info on all of our awesome programming as well as the team behind the shows. Leave us your feedback, join in the conversation, and be a part of the action. Find the Hollow Nine Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at info@hollow9.com or at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Join in the fun. Hollow 9.
If you think making me repeat myself is going to somehow make the story change, or if you just don't want to hear what it is I actually have to say, but again, we changed course based on orders received on the flash ban from company headquarters. Code Gold, command eyes only. Standard operating procedure, as I know you were aware. Search and rescue would rarely venture into an unregulated area without more concrete proof of life. We sure found something out there, all right.
When you watch it as a little kid, you know, it's a monster movie, it's creepy, but then there's all the weird artificial intelligence stuff, there's the, like, rapey nature of the facehuggers and all that.
Why don't you stick your face in the egg, dude? Is there an egg opening in front of you? Stick your face in there and see what happens.
When I fall asleep at night, I have this irrational fear that something is going to crawl inside and, like, lay eggs inside of me. I'm actually wondering, now that we're talking about this, if this might have been the impetus for that.
You know, Star Wars comes out, and they go, what other movies do we have set in space? Boom, Alien gets green light the next day.
Very similar to just even how our government is in preparation for something where they didn't know exactly what was in store, like specifically the xenomorphs.
Bodily fluids, and it's not just blood. There's a lot of, like, grease, and there's a lot of sweat. And if it wasn't the blood that got me, it was the sheer amount of sweat.
We're on a mission to bring back knowledge of the xenomorph. The end of all mankind, all wrapped up in a bow, just waiting for us to come along. You're gonna find yourself staring down the barrel of a living, breathing devil in the flesh that bleeds acid and lives to kill us.